Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. My guests today are calling in from around the world, and we're going to be talking about research they've done on the potential of missed organ donors, specifically those donating after circulatory death. Professor David Pilcher is Deputy Director of Intensive Care and Hyperbaric Medicine at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne. He's joined by Dr. Sandeep Rakra, who is an Intensive Care Registrar, also at the Alfred. And calling in from sunny Spain is Dr. Helen Opdam, who is an Intensivist and National Medical Director of Donate Life, which is administered by the Australian Organ and Tissue Authority. Their research, by the way, can be found at mja.com.au from the 25th of September. It is open access and well worth the read. What is the formal definition of donation after circulatory death?
Donation after circulatory death is when a person is able to donate organs for transplantation after they have died, with death being declared after their circulation has ceased and their heart has stopped beating.
So that's different, obviously, from donation after brain death. Is that difference part of why we're not doing as many of these donations as perhaps we should be?
The earliest organ donations that occurred after people had died were through donation after circulatory death. Then the whole recognition of the entity of brain death, that is when a person's whole brain has died, yet they're on a mechanical ventilator and their circulation continues and heart continues to beat. That whole recognition of that condition occurred in the last few decades, and then it was realised that people in that situation were really ideal in a way to donate organs for transplantation. Donation after death almost, you know, exclusively occurred after brain death. But due to two reasons, really, families raising donation and wanting their relative to be a donor in situations where death was inevitable, but brain death had not occurred and was not going to occur, and the ongoing insufficient number of organs for the people who need a transplant led to donation after circulatory death becoming an increasing pathway to donation in Australia but also other parts of the world.
Now, we know that Australia lags behind a lot of other countries in terms of donation rates. Can somebody specify those donation rates for me? Just remind me what the numbers are.
So, look, a lot's been done in Australia in the last, since 2009, when there was a national reform initiated to properly fund, resource and organise donation in Australia. And since that time, donation and transplantation rates have more than doubled. So back prior to 2009, we used to have about 200 people who donated organs after death, whereas in 2014, the year of this study, there were 378, and last year in 2016, 503 people who donated organs after death. So really a dramatic increase. And whereas back in 2009, internationally, Australia was ranked at number 28 in the world in terms of our rate of donation, last year in 2016, we were ranked at 14th. Tremendous amount has been done with great success, but I think we all believe, and this study shows, there's more potential to further increase rates of donation in Australia.
So that's what you set out to test. What gave you the inkling that there were more patients there that could be potential donors?
With the reforms that were put in 2009, part of that was linking a group of hospitals together in the Donate Life network.
Yeah.
Who were likely to be the hospitals where there was the greatest potential for donation. And with that, was set up an audit process that collected information on all deaths that occurred within the intensive care shortly after discharge from the intensive care or had occurred within emergency departments. And to collect some information on those patients as well, collect information on organ function, on circumstances around the death, whether there were discussions about donation, whether patients went on to become donors. And having collected that data for a few years, it became obvious to us that there was the potential to look to see whether there was more potential for donation, and in particular for donation after circulatory death. Many other countries don't have this capacity to look into it or even ask the question.
Yeah.
We're fortunate in Australia to be able to look more fully and to question and to say, are there more donors out there who could be considered? And really that was what drove us to sort of look at this question.
Tell us a little bit, maybe Sandeep, tell us a little bit about the design of the research.
As David was explaining, the Donate Life audit we saw as this really great vehicle to estimate the country's potential for donation after circulatory death. And what we decided to do was generate ideal and expanded organ donor criteria based on previous international and national guidelines. And we actually discussed it with regional organ donation specialists, like liver donation, heart donation.
Mm-hmm.
And we applied this criteria to the Donate Life database and tried to find how many potential donors there were. And we excluded those people who actually became donors, and we focused on those people in whom organ donation was not discussed and who we felt would be eligible organ donors.
And what did you find?
What we found was that out of the roughly 9,000 patients who were intubated and in the intensive care unit or the emergency department, there were around 200 actual donors after circulatory death. But applying these criteria that we found, there were around 500 extra potential donors that either fit the ideal or the expanded criteria. We assumed that the consent rate, which is 60% previously within the country, if we applied that 60% rate to that 500, there'd be around 300 extra donors that we thought would be a practical number in Australia.
It begs the question, why are we missing these potential donors?
As Helen mentioned, donation in recent years has traditionally been predominantly through the brain death pathway.
Yeah.
And identifying donors people who could be donors that aren't brain dead is a bit more difficult. And it's more difficult because you have to identify a person who is likely to die.
Yes.
Before they die, and have the discussions with the family, know that the prognosis is certain, be able to have a pretty good idea that the person has at least one organ that is suitable for donation and transplantation into someone else, and also be aware that this is a patient who is going to die in a short time frame after taking them off all of the mechanical cardiorespiratory supports that we use in the ICU. So identification of these patients is more difficult. The other thing that's changed over time is that we've become aware that patients who would normally not have been considered for donation have now potentially could be, because we've realised that patients who are older can still become donors. Patients
right.
that might have chronic diseases of one organ could still donate another organ, for instance. And those are situations that people and clinicians who are in the ICU previously either weren't aware of or wouldn't have considered donation, but now donation would be possible for these patients. And the field has been changing over time as we've become aware that there's more of these patients out there. This type of research allows us to sort of quantify how many there are at the same time as we're actually the suitability criteria are actually improving. In addition, we have to be able to provide the resources in the hospitals to facilitate the donation process.
Right,
and it
yes.
takes a lot of work to work up a patient to provide the appropriate surgical retrieval services. And those haven't always traditionally been available, and they're becoming more available with the work of the Donate Life network.
Is what's needed? Is it a rewrite of the guidelines, of the criteria? Is it better training in terms of having the conversations with the families? Where's the breaking point here? Where's the point where you can see a good improvement coming?
A lot of things are have been put in place since the national reform began in 2009, and they continue to evolve with additional strategy. And it's sort of a moving feast as, for example, medical suitability criteria change, then, you know, more education needs to be given to staff to improve their ability to identify potential donors. It's just one small thing. There's many elements to this system. So all of that work continues to happen, processes continue to evolve, and already we've had in place automatic sort of referral clinical triggers in hospitals to ensure that patients who, particularly there was a focus on patients who could become brain dead in the past, but particularly patients with a severe brain injury who were having end-of-life care discussions, that those patients would be flagged with donation specialist staff. What I think we've learned from this study is that the additional patients, including those who have no brain injury, no stroke, no trauma, but who may be dying from other causes, these are the ones that are particularly easy to overlook, and that this study has highlighted as a group of potentially suitable donors. So a further strategy that we're putting in place in all of those hospitals throughout Australia is an automatic referral or notification of all patients in whom there's a plan to move towards end-of-life care, for them to be flagged with donation specialist staff so they can be evaluated to see whether they could at all be a suitable organ donor.
So what's next? What's the next line? Is it, is it more research? Is it another round of education? Do the colleges need to become involved at the training level?
The key things really to further increase donation, and they're all being embedded in the hospital and they continue to evolve, are really strategies to ensure that anyone who can donate is identified and that they're referred to the Donate Life donation specialist staff, that we have the resources in hospital to properly support the families of those patients and to work those individuals up so that they can become donors, that we have the retrieval surgical staff and the downstream resources, including adequately resourced transplant units, and we have the entire system working optimally to make sure that whole process from donor identification through to the transplantation of organs happening optimally. And this sort of audit process and research is really valuable in shining the light on areas where there is further potential and work to be done. And I think, you know, further strategies to ensure that everyone having end-of-life care is flagged to be evaluated to their potential for donation is really a key outcome for this, that this study supports.
A lot of our listeners are general practitioners. What role do they have in, for example, preparing their patients for end-of-life and advanced care planning and organ donation conversations? Is there a role for them to play?
Oh, absolutely. Look, GPs are incredibly important. They're the most trusted medical advisors for many of us in the community. And the most important thing that, we can all do in our community is be prepared to be a donor. And then, importantly, having made that decision that you're willing to donate to save the lives of others after your death, sign up on the National Australian Organ Donor Register, and there's links through to that register on the donatelife.gov.au website. But also let those closest to you know, your family know, your willingness to be a donor. We know that when someone's registered on the Australian Organ Donor Register, then when it comes to the stressful situation of sudden death in hospital where donation's been discussed with families, we've got a consent rate of 90% or higher.
Yeah.
In situations where someone can donate in a hospital and the family don't know what their wishes were with respect to donation and they're not registered on the Australian Organ Donor Register, then the consent rate is only at about 50%. GPs are really important in, informing individuals about the importance of donation. If we want transplantation to be available to us all, in our community, and we're all more likely for ourselves or our loved ones to need a transplant than even to die in a situation where we ourselves can be donors. You know, if we want transplantation available, then we all have to be willing to donate and join in the register and letting our family know our wishes are the most important things.
I noticed that France has just brought in an opt-out system. Is that something any of you would like to see here in Australia?
Yeah, look, a lot of countries have sort of officially opt out, but in reality they operate in the same way that Australia and, you know, the UK and America work, and the family are always involved in discussing these decisions at the end of someone's life. So even in opt-out countries, the family, the consent of families is sought. So I think people like to think it's a magic solution for increasing rates of donation. But if you go to France, if you go to Spain, which is an international leader in donation, what you learn is what's most important is properly organising and funding a system to ensure that there's good donor detection, which is what this study is all about, that families are well supported and communicated with by highly trained professionals. Again, something important that's been embedded in this country, and that the whole system's sufficiently resourced to really get optimal outcomes. So at this point in time, it's not been felt by various state governments that have looked at opt-out as the right fit for Australia, but who knows what may happen in the future. One of the challenges with DCD, and I think David talked a little bit about it, is with brain destination, when someone's been determined to be to have developed brain death and they're declared deceased, it's a more certain context in which to discuss the possibility of donation with families.
Yeah.
I think one of the problems with, you know, and if families agree in that situation and the person considered medical, evaluated as being medically suitable to donate organs for transplantation, then, you know, donation almost inevitably occurs. One of the challenges with donation after circulatory death is the uncertainty of it. For patients who, you know, the family provide consent, they're thought to be medically suitable and all of the donation assessment and workups undertaken, and then treatment is withdrawn with donation planned, 30% of those patients don't actually die in the time frame required for successful donation and transplantation to occur. So I think that's one of the other barriers. Predicting whether death will occur in a sufficiently quick time frame, clinicians provide the same end-of-life care as they would if the person was not undergoing planned donation. There's no hastening of death. And death really needs to occur within 90 minutes or so of the withdrawal of the mechanical ventilator and other supportive treatments. So a proportion of patients who, you know, there's a lot of expectation, the family often very committed to donation at that point, a proportion of patients, 30% or so, don't actually go on to donation. And although families are often satisfied that everything was done to try to have that wish fulfilled, I think it's a more challenging circumstance than in some regard than brain death donation.
When we were actually examining the results, we were, I guess, one of the things that slightly surprised us was that the potential seemed to be mainly in kidney and lung donation, rather than there being a much smaller additional potential for liver and heart donation. And one of the things that we're not sure is whether we've got our criteria too restrictive or too expansive. And this is an area that we need to look at more. And there's definitely more potential for kidneys and lungs, and hopefully for livers and potentially hearts as well. These are all areas that are developing and will continue to develop as the Donate Life and the actual processes around donation actually become even more embedded in the hospitals where most of the donation activity is, and hopefully potentially in other hospitals as well.
Terrific. Thanks, everybody.
Good on you, Kate. Thanks again.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.nja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.